It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. This is episode 763 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 3rd, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. Happy July 4th weekend. I know a lot of people very happy to have tomorrow off. Going to be hanging out, going to be enjoying the nice weather, going to be putting up some burgers, putting up some hot dogs, blowing up some fireworks, hopefully not blowing up themselves. I am feeling better. I want to thank everybody for all the nice messages. I'm still sick, but I'm definitely doing better than I was a week ago, that's for sure. And not out of the woods yet, but I am doing better. So thank you for all the nice messages. One of the emails that I received was from Anthony Anguiano. He was checking in on me. If you listen to the podcast, you're very familiar with Anthony's name. You've heard me shout him out numerous times here on the show. He was a big fan of the podcast, bought a whole bunch of Sound Off shirts. You know, he would often ask questions, not just of me, but of all of you in the Facebook group. He and I shared the same favorite movie. He was a big fan of The Dark Knight. He would always talk about it. He sent me an email last Saturday asking how I was feeling because he had heard that I had COVID. The very next day, Anthony passed away. And I didn't know this until Tuesday when his brother Chris reached out to me on Facebook. That was shocking to hear. It's not very often I sit here and I'm at a loss for words, but I was at a loss for words. I know he dealt with a lot of loss in his family recently, so much so that when I heard about this, it was just incomprehensible to me. What I knew of him, he seemed like a genuine good person who was always happy, very positive, and the world is a little bit darker today for him not being in it. So I will always appreciate the support that he showed for me and my work, and he will always be a member of our extended Sound Off family. You know, there's a famous quote, I think it's from Winnie the Pooh of all things, but somebody shared it with me after my mother passed away. How lucky I am to have something that makes saying goodbye so hard. My condolences to his brother Chris, their mother, and all of his friends. So one last shout out for awesome Anthony Anguiano. We're going to miss you, buddy. There is an ongoing 4th of July sale on ProWrestlingTees.com for those who are interested. There's still a couple days left. Sale goes through this Tuesday, July 5th at 1 Eastern. If you want to get 20% off any shirt in the Sound Off store, all you have to do is use the code America22 when you check out. But you can go to ProWrestlingTees.com/SoloMonsterSoundsOff. That's 20% off all the shirts in our store. And I know a lot of you have also been using our Audible link. Keep doing that. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster gets you one free audiobook of your choice. You can make that Mox, the new book by John Moxley, narrated by Moxley himself. Normally it would go for $21. You can get it for free when you use our link to sign up for a 30-day trial of the service. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Over 9 hours of audio. Narrated by Mox himself.
Fuck Kevin Dunn.
Yes, I agree. That's right. Fuck Kevin Dunn. I agree with Moxley.
Fuck Kevin Dunn.
That's right. So again, you get one credit for one free book. If you're an Amazon Prime member, I believe you get 2 credits. So you can get more than one book, potentially. If you're a Prime member, you might be able to cash in and get 2 for free. And you might want to consider the Guy Evans book, Nitro. Talked about that last week. A great book. You want the lowdown, all the business, all the business knowledge that you can possibly get on the Nitro era. straight from interviews with Turner executives and people within the company who you may never have heard from before. It's a great book. It's a long book, but you can get the audiobook for free on Audible as well. I want to say thank you to our PayPal producers for this week, including the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. Paul, thank you very much. Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, who just celebrated his 2-year wedding anniversary on June 25th, and he celebrated a birthday 2 days later, the same day that he and his wife flew to Aruba for their honeymoon. It took them 2 years, but they finally got that honeymoon in there. So congrats to you both. I hope it was worth the wait. And happy birthday, Robert. Big B Bryant Becerra, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Killshot Keith Hart, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Shin Superkick Akuma, John Raging Mad Riffle, and the Iowan Corn Farmer himself, Jesse Lampier. Thank you all for your support. This Wednesday, we're going to be live on YouTube at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. If you are a YouTube channel member, we're going live for our next watch-along. It's going to be the 10-man tag team main event. 25 years later to the day, the Canadian Stampede In Your House main event. We're going to be watching that live and talking about it. So if you are a channel member, regardless of which tier you are on, you will be able to join me live on Wednesday afternoon before we go live for the Dynamite review that night. Money in the Bank was last night from Las Vegas, originally going to be at Allegiant Stadium. They were going to have a whole big crowd there, tens of thousands of people, and it didn't exactly work out the way that they had hoped. So they were going to move it to the T-Mobile Arena, but there was a UFC show last night as well, so they ended up in the MGM Grand Garden Arena, the same building that I was in for the very first AEW Double or Nothing show. It's a nice little building they have there. I actually think, frankly, it probably worked out better this way, because when you have a smaller building like this, and if you get a reasonably hot crowd, with the acoustics and everything, it just sounds better. And this crowd was into a lot of different things on this show. What I thought overall was a thumbs-up show. Austin Theory was a late addition to the men's Money in the Bank ladder match. They had 7 men. Out comes Adam Pearce, telling us that now we have an 8th entrant. And out came Theory, and he went on to win the match. One of the things I liked about this match going in is the fact that you had no less than 4 men, in my opinion, who could have believably won this match. As soon as Theory came out and they added him to the match, it took away that unpredictability. That's the one thing I hated about the way they did this, is that it made the finish predictable, because why else would Theory be added to the match at the last minute if he wasn't going to go on to win the entire thing, especially after he already lost his U.S. title earlier in the show? It just looked like things were set up for him to go on to win this match. Now, Seth Rollins had to be the favorite going in. A lot of people's favorite. And I think Seth Rollins winning the briefcase would have made for a better tease for him possibly cashing in at SummerSlam, given the history of him doing that with Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns. But they see Theory as the future of this company, and I can't fault them for wanting to push a new face to the top. I thought it was an excellent match. I mean, the finish was, I could see where people would be deflated by the finish and would be upset by the finish, but I thought it was an excellent match overall. Everybody had a chance to shine. Even Omos. Yeah, they figured out a good way to make use of him in this match, which culminated in him being body surfed by all the other members of the match on the floor. They body surfed him into the air and down through the announce table, and we never saw him again after that. But I thought it was an excellent main event. Now, the question about Theory, now that he has the briefcase, does he cash in during the last man standing match at the end of the month at SummerSlam? Because if he cashes in, how does he not win the championship? What would be the point of him cashing in and then losing? To me, it feels too rushed to put the title on him right now. I don't think Roman Reigns loses the championship before Clash at the Castle at the earliest. You know, unless they can figure out a way to split the titles before then. I think they're going to be split by the time we get to Survivor Series anyway. But how they would go about splitting them in the event of a cash-in at SummerSlam, when it really is just one title, effectively, that's being defended, that I haven't figured out that part yet. So I don't know what they have in mind for Theory. I'm sure they're going to tease the hell out of the possibility of him cashing in at SummerSlam. Doesn't mean he will. You know, there's another idea. If Theory wanted to wait until WrestleMania, or they just kind of forgot about it, didn't talk about it, and didn't want people to remember the fact that he even had the briefcase, and then he went and tried to cash in at WrestleMania. The idea of him not cashing in on Roman Reigns, but cashing in on the man who beats Roman Reigns. If they were to hold off and wait and have Cody Rhodes, assuming he's back in time and he goes on to challenge for the title and he wins the Royal Rumble and whatever, maybe he has one more match with Seth Rollins and puts his WrestleMania main event on the line like a lot of dumb baby faces have done before, beats Rollins again, and then goes on to the main event of WrestleMania. What if you were to have Cody Rhodes be the one to beat Roman Reigns, only to then have Theory immediately cash in and take the championship? It would get him tremendous heat. You know, if they actually hold out until WrestleMania and they finally have Roman Reigns lose the titles, only to put the belt or belts right back on another heel. After 2.5 years of a dominant heel champion, they turn around and put the fucking thing right back on another heel. I mean, look, this company is all about heat. All about heels and all about heat. Always has been. I can totally see them doing that. Cody gets his moment, but then immediately has it taken away from him. And now he has to chase to get it back because the money is in the chase, as they say, right? I would hate that just because to take that moment away and not have him, you know, celebrate as they go off the air and just be able to enjoy the moment and let it breathe and everything. I don't think I'd be very big on that idea. I'm just saying I could totally see them doing something like that. There was something that happened after the match, after the show went off the air. Baron Corbin attacked Pat McAfee. He came out of the crowd. He attacked Pat. He wrapped his arm around his throat and basically dragged him over the barricade and started pummeling him in the audience, threw him back over the barricade, and then gave him the end of days on the floor. And then he leaned over and he accepted Pat's challenge to a match at SummerSlam. So it is official now. And Pat McAfee then went straight from the MGM Grand to the T-Mobile Arena with a neck brace on to sell the attack. He does a better job of selling than most wrestlers do these days. Put the neck brace on to go over to the T-Mobile Arena to watch the UFC show with Vince McMahon, Stephanie McMahon, and Triple H. They all left the building immediately after the pay-per-view, and they went straight to the UFC show. They left Bruce behind to clean up the building. This is your mess now, Bruce. You clean it up. We'll see you on Monday. I wonder what Vince thought when they hit the Undertaker's music and Israel Adesanya did the full Undertaker entrance with the urn and everything when he came out. I wonder what he was thinking. And Adesanya then went on to win his fight. That would have been a pretty shitty tribute to the Undertaker had he gone in there and lost. So at least he won. Lashley is the new United States champion. I mentioned that Theory lost his title earlier in the night. Bobby Lashley is once again U.S. champion. The crowd loved Lashley. Lashley was super over in Las Vegas, and I think it's smart. I think it's smart to put the U.S. title back on him at a time when both titles are still being held hostage by Roman Reigns. It gives Monday Night Raw a strong babyface champion on top, so long as the show is without the WWE title, which it's going to be for at least a little while longer, since they very clearly have no intention of sending Roman Reigns to Raw, except for maybe a token appearance where he waves every now and then. I still can't believe they put both belts on somebody who they knew was going to be working fewer dates coming out of WrestleMania. That's ridiculous, but I like it. I like Lashley being the one now to kind of stand on top of Raw with that U.S. title, and now at least there's some strong champion on top of that brand that can defend that title. And also, the other thing I like about this, and this is WWE. It's only July, right? We just got into the month of July. Survivor Series is still many months away. And it is very likely, more so I think, that Lashley will no longer be U.S. champion by November than Walter would not be the Intercontinental champion. But as things currently stand at this moment, Lashley is the U.S. champion, and Walter is the Intercontinental champion, right? Gunther is the Intercontinental champion on SmackDown. And so long as both men hold on to their respective titles, the match at Survivor Series would be Lashley against Walter. So I'm pulling for both of them. I'm hoping that both of them can hold on to those titles at least for a few more months. The other big story at Money in the Bank outside of Theory was Liv Morgan. Liv Morgan won the women's Money in the Bank briefcase in a, I thought, a sloppy ladder match. I didn't think it was all that great, but she wins the briefcase. You can see the tears in her eyes and how emotional she is about the whole thing and how much this meant to her. And then later on in the show, Ronda Rousey defeats Natalya, which, I mean, who didn't predict that? Both women's champions were going to win their matches. Everybody knew that. Bianca Belair was not losing her title to Carmella, and Natty was not taking the title from Ronda Rousey. So Ronda retains the championship over Natty, but is selling a knee injury. They play Liv Morgan's music, and here comes Liv, and she hands over the briefcase, they ring the bell, and it didn't take more than 60 seconds. She rolled up Ronda Rousey, she pinned her, and the new SmackDown Women's Champion is Liv Morgan from Monday Night Raw, who I guess now officially is on Friday Night SmackDown. And she got a great reaction. Everybody was very happy for Liv Morgan, myself included. It was a happy moment. You could tell how much it meant to her. All the bullshit, you know, all those matches with Becky Lynch and all those opportunities for the Raw Women's Championship, and she failed. At every single turn, she failed. Even though she was one of the more over women and still is one of the more over women on that roster. She has a lot of fans. She has a big fan following. And I said it last night on the stream. You could tell how much she has improved in the ring. It's been a noticeable improvement. She's not fucking, I mean, she's not Trish Stratus in there or, you know, any of these other women that you think of in history. She's not Manami Toyota, but she's in there. And she is much improved from the way she was even a year ago. She's put the work in. And so it was nice to see, you know, the big payoff for her. But I also said something else on the stream last night when I was reviewing the show. And I said, if I were Liv Morgan, I would not get too comfortable with that SmackDown Women's title. And I would not get too comfortable with that title, mainly because Charlotte Flair is going to be on her way back any week now. It's about that time of year where Charlotte Flair, after being gone for a while, comes back and takes her rightful place at the top of the food chain with whatever championship is on the brand that she is currently working. In this case, it would be the SmackDown women's title. So I'm sure Charlotte Flair is going to be on her way back very soon. But I didn't know what the status of Ronda Rousey was. I didn't know if this meant that Ronda is going to be going away again for a while before she comes back, or if she was just going to show up on SmackDown this week and they're going to start building to a proper match between her and Liv Morgan at SummerSlam. And based on what Meltzer said last night, that appears to be the plan. It does not look like Ronda Rousey is leaving. It does not look like she is going anywhere. And the plan right now for SummerSlam, until Charlotte works her way in there, is to do Ronda Rousey against Liv Morgan for the SmackDown Women's Championship. So whether it's Ronda Rousey or Charlotte Flair or even Bayley, who should be on her way back to one of the two shows very soon, I don't think Liv Morgan even makes it out of this month with that championship. So she should celebrate. She should hit, I said last night, hit the strip, celebrate in Vegas, make a night out of it, enjoy it, pop the champagne, because I don't think this party is going to be lasting for very long. But that appears to be the plan right now for SummerSlam. It looks like it's going to be Liv Morgan against Ronda Rousey. And Ronda Rousey, when she lost that title last night, there was no anger. There was no, you know, kind of, Liv wants a handshake and Ronda just storms off, or anything like that. Liv was standing there, and Ronda simply handed the title over and hugged her and was basically like, hey, congratulations, you beat me, and she left. So there was no tension there whatsoever. If they're going to build to a rematch, they're already starting out on the wrong foot. Because the way they did that last night, there's absolutely no tension whatsoever. But now they have a few weeks, I guess, to try to build tension on TV if that's the match that they're going to do. We had a tag team championship match between the Usos and the Street Profits that was tag team excellence. And it was a great example of why tag team wrestling can be so great. When you have two teams who just gel together, They just, you put them in the ring and they do good things together. They make wonderful music in the ring together. That's what these two teams did last night at Money in the Bank. They had an excellent match. They gave them a long time, too. They gave them about 23 minutes to go in there. And so, you know, the Usos would slow down the pace. And then the Street Profits, you know, somebody would make the hot tag and they would build them back up. And they had a couple of great near falls in there. The fans were hanging on to everyone. The fans really badly wanted to see the Street Profits take those titles. I think also they just wanted the Usos to lose. It might have been more, not that they don't like the Street Profits, but I think more than anything, any team that gets in the ring now with the Usos, it's more about, less about who that team is and more just, I want to see the Usos lose. So they were really into all those near falls, and in the end it didn't matter because the Usos still came out with the win, but there was a controversial finish to the match because upon the replay being shown, it was very clear that Montez Ford, who got pinned by Jey Uso, that Montez's shoulder was up off the mat. When Jey pinned him, he kind of cradled Montez's shoulder, which just pulled it up off the mat. I mean, there shouldn't have even been a one count. And the referee didn't see it, though. And the referee counted three. So the Street Profits have a built-in excuse now as to why they deserve a rematch, because his shoulder was never down. He never should have been pinned in the first place. So this is now going to lead to a rematch, probably at SummerSlam, maybe with a stipulation. They could always go two out of three falls, or, I mean, I don't really have much of an interest in a ladder match, given that we just had two of them last night. But, yeah, they'll probably want to add some kind of stipulation to the match. And I'm all for it. Let's get them back in the ring again. Even though we've seen plenty of the Usos and the Street Profits and tag and singles matches over the last several weeks, when you have a match as good as the one that we had last night, I will not complain about getting a rematch between these two teams. And I also said that when this year is over, this is going to be a match that I think is on a lot of people's lists when they are considering what is the match of the year, what is the tag team match of the year. I don't know that it's going to end up being the match of the year on all of those lists, but I definitely think it'll be in the conversation. Now, there's another aspect to this, and it ties into a news item earlier in the week from Fightful Select, so I may as well bring it up now. But several days ago, Fightful had an item that, as recently as this week, there have been serious discussions internally in WWE about calling up NXT star Solo Sikoa to the main roster. And for those who don't know, Solo Sikoa is the brother of Jimmy and Jey. He is the third Uso. That's why he gets Us chants when he's out there in the NXT, you know, the little Nickelodeon arena they have there. So now there's serious talk about calling him up to the main roster. And they have not heard a certain brand associated with where he would be called up, but, you know, SmackDown would make the most sense because that's where the Bloodline rules. And that's where his brothers are, and that's where his cousin Roman Reigns is. It's only natural that if Solo Sikoa is going to get called up, he should be part of the Bloodline, or at the very least, the Bloodline should want to recruit him. Maybe he doesn't want to be part of the Bloodline. Maybe they want to keep him babyface, and he doesn't partner with his brothers, although I think that would be weird. I think it's just natural to put them all together. Maybe they do a deal where, you know, they have a rematch at SummerSlam with the Usos and the Street Profits, and maybe that's where Solo Sikoa makes his main roster debut. Maybe they wait until SummerSlam and Solo Sikoa makes an appearance and he interferes and he helps his brothers beat the Street Profits, and that is his official introduction into the Bloodline. It's something to consider with all these, you know, all this talk going on that he could potentially be main roster bound very soon. But this was tag team wrestling at its finest, and now if only they took tag team wrestling seriously enough to add more tag teams to the, well, really both rosters, the Raw and the SmackDown roster, because the tag team division individually on both shows, even if you combine them, frankly, it's not very good. They have some really good teams, but not nearly enough of them. If only they took tag team wrestling more seriously, then they could have built up a really big tag team division the way that AEW has. It's one of AEW's strengths. All the teams they have. It's one of their greatest strengths, one of their greatest assets. And there's no reason WWE can't have a tag team division like that. Then we would be able to get even more matches like this. But I said last night, you know, watching Montez Ford out there, And now I'm seeing stories about, you know, people talking about Montez Ford. And I mean, I've been saying this for a while, but I said it last night, even during the review before I saw any other, you know, news items or rumors. I said, I want you to pay attention a year from now. When we're talking about Money in the Bank 2023, I could see Montez Ford winning that men's Money in the Bank briefcase. Because he's on his way. He's going to have that singles run. It's just a matter of when. And you know that every time they go out there, Angelo Dawkins, he's got his working boots on. He wants to go out there and have the best possible Street Profits match they can have so that the company won't think of splitting them up. Because he has to know that the moment that happens, the moment the split happens, it's no different than with Otis and Tucker and, I mean, any other team you want to think of. The moment that split happens, there's going to be one guy who gets pushed and there's going to be one guy who gets the shaft. And Angelo Dawkins is good, but Angelo Dawkins is not going to be the one getting the push between those two guys. One guy is going to get the push and one guy is going to get the shaft. And it ain't going to be Montez Ford getting the shaft. And he knows that. But Montez Ford has a very bright future as a single star. Babyface, heel, whichever. I think there could be a lot of money in him as a heel. But you could tell, like, his physique has changed a little bit. He's put on a little bit of muscle. They even mentioned it on commentary last night. I can't see how Vince McMahon doesn't look at this guy and see dollar signs. So it's only a matter of time. And so a year from now, Money in the Bank, keep that name in mind. Montez Ford. He could be the one holding up that briefcase next year. There was a vignette on this show that got a lot of people talking. It was a vignette for a mystery person, a mystery man, presumably, whose face we never saw. There was a lot of imagery in it. And at first, I didn't get all of it. I spotted a gold medal was shown, but I didn't pick up on all the different things at first. So then, thanks to the sleuths on social media, people were posting screenshots, and then I got to put the pieces of the puzzle together and figure it out on my own. So I knew I wasn't seeing things. There was a gold medal that got flashed at one point. There was a cross shown multiple times. There were candles. There were a pair of glasses that were shown that looked a lot like the old Dudley Boys glasses. They showed the Hardy Boy armbands, the arm sleeves. They showed a Texas license plate laying on the ground that said Latino Heat on it. What do all of these things have in common? Edge. They're all parts of Edge's career. He feuded with Kurt Angle, who was an Olympic gold medalist. That's where he got his first big break as a single star, was that feud with Kurt. And we had, don't forget, we had, Team Wreck, right? Edge and Christian, and I guess Rhino was part of that too, but Kurt Angle was part of their little group there too for a while. So Kurt was a part of Edge's career. Edge teamed with Christian, so he had all the crosses, so there's some kind of, connection there. Obviously, Edge was part of all the TLC matches with the Dudleys and with the Hardys. Even the look of the video itself, even though we couldn't see who this person was, the look and the colors and the dark nature of the video, it reminded me of one of those Edge debut vignettes that they aired in 98 when he was kind of running around in the streets. So this is definitely for Edge. Sorry to upset all the Bray Wyatt fans out there, but the first time anybody sees anything dark, if there's any kind of promo that has any kind of dark imagery in it, if there's candles, if there's crosses, if there's some kind of a bird or a crow or something, oh, it's Bray Wyatt. It's got to be the return of Bray Wyatt. It's not Bray Wyatt. It is the return of Edge. And we'll see. I don't know if he'll change his look up again. He already cut his hair. There's not much he can do about that. But we'll see if they go with him against Finn Balor as the match for Edge at SummerSlam. So again, overall, I thought this was a very good show. The U.S. title match, the tag team title match, and the main event are really what carried the show. And the Liv Morgan cash-in was the feel-good moment of the night. The theory thing, we'll see where they go with it. Because, again, it's very clear that he, in their mind, he is the future. And it's not that I have an issue with them pushing a new, younger face, right? He's 24 years old. He's going to be a big star. He's going to be a world champion one day. I don't think today should be that day. I do think it's too fast, it's too much too soon, and it could backfire on them. You know, if they push him to the championship in the next few weeks, I mean, again, I think that's way too much, way too soon. Doesn't mean you can't push him and get him ready for that spot. And he's not the one who I would have gone with in that Money in the Bank match. But as far as them pushing a younger face, I mean, I don't have an issue with that. It's just the way that they went about doing it. Again, they have to be very careful that this doesn't blow up in their face. And unfortunately, if it blows up in their face, it could blow up in Theory's face. And you don't want to do anything to kind of stunt his growth. It's not his fault. Always comes down to the booking. And sometimes you're just a slave to the booking. And it's not through any fault of your own that, you know, the fans could turn on you or feel like you're being shoved down their throat and all that kind of stuff. And we've seen this story play out many times before. I don't want to see the same thing happen with Theory. Since I brought up NXT, I'll mention this here. Io Shirai has not signed her newest contract offer that WWE presented to her. Unless she signs in the next few weeks, she is going to be a free agent by next month if she does not sign her new deal. I don't know if it's the end of this month or sometime in August, but within the next month or month and a half, she is very likely going to end up being a free agent. And she has told people in Japan that when her contract is up, she wants to go back to Japan to be closer to her family. So that is the latest update on Io Shirai, who has been injured. She's been out with an injury, I think, since February. We haven't seen her on TV in quite some time. But it looks like she is on her way out of the company. And it is amazing to me that they had somebody like Io Shirai under contract, toiling away for years in NXT. She never even sniffed the main roster. She worked multiple main roster dark matches as recently as the beginning of this year, January and February. She was in the ring working with Dakota Kai and I think Raquel and other people in dark matches before Raw and SmackDown. And Vince McMahon had no interest in her. Imagine being Vince McMahon and watching Io Shirai and saying, eh, not really interested. So you know what? I'm happy that she's leaving. Good for her. Because it's very clear she wasn't going anywhere here in this company. And her talents were being wasted. Imagine putting her in these dark, even putting her in dark matches in the first place. But imagine putting her in these dark matches and saying, I don't see anything in Io Shirai. We'll call up Aaliyah. We'll call her up. But this Io girl here, I don't see what the big deal is. Forbidden Door was last Sunday, so I did not get a chance to comment on it on the main show. You can find the full recap elsewhere. It is my favorite show of 2022 so far, even after Money in the Bank last night. Money in the Bank was not better than Forbidden Door. I had a lot of fun with WrestleMania this year. I thought WrestleMania was actually very good between the two nights. But as a one-night wrestling pay-per-view, I don't believe there has been a better show all year so far than Forbidden Door. Top to bottom, not a bad match on the entire main card. They had a hot crowd at the United Center in Chicago. Big crowd too, 17,000 plus. They had a few surprises on the show. Some great wrestling. You put it all together and it gets a very enthusiastic thumbs up from me. The one match that I watched back the next day in its entirety. There was only one match that I wanted to go back and watch without the pressure of having to take notes and pay attention to every little minute detail because I had to do it, you know, I had to go live for the review and make sure I didn't miss anything. I wanted to go back and watch one match and just sit back and enjoy it. And I did. And that one match out of everything on the card was the IWGP United States Championship match with Will Ospreay and Orange Cassidy. That was my match of the night. With the benefit of hindsight, now that the show is over, the pay-per-view sounds like it did somewhere in the range of, I guess, 127, maybe 130,000 pay-per-view buys, which is down from what they usually do. But this was a special show that didn't even exist on the calendar before. This was also a test for AEW because they don't usually do back-to-back pay-per-views. They have four pay-per-views a year. This is the first time they've had a pay-per-view so soon after one of their main shows with a bunch of people who are not, you know, AEW talents. That was one of the criticisms of the show. There was a lot of New Japan talent. Some people are not familiar with all the New Japan talent. And so I don't look at that as being a bad number. The fact that they were able to clear 100,000 and well over 100,000, I see that as being a good sign that there is enough interest to come back and bring this show back again next year and make it an annual thing. You know, to pull 100,000 buys out of nothing while putting 17,000 people in the United Center and doing over $1 million at the gate. As cursed as that show was with all the injuries going into it, I don't see how they don't make this an annual event. There will absolutely be a Forbidden Door 2. Whether it happens here or in Japan, that we don't know. But there absolutely will be a Forbidden Door 2. And they pulled this off without CM Punk, without Bryan Danielson, and without Kenny Omega. Plenty of big matches left on the table for them to come back with the next time when hopefully everybody is active and healthy. Jon Moxley is the interim AEW World Champion. He becomes the first ever two-time AEW World Champion. And now we just wait for the inevitable showdown with CM Punk. It all depends on when Punk can come back. And if Punk can come back in time for All Out, they're probably going to be right back in Chicago. If they end up running the United Center again in September, I mean, I don't think they'll have any issue packing the building in if the main event is Punk against Moxley, but I just think that's completely ridiculous. You're going to do back-to-back pay-per-views in the same fucking, not even the same city, the same fucking building. Why not run Canada? Why not make your Canadian debut at All Out and run, you know, a nice-sized building in Toronto? It's not like they're going to have for that first show in Canada. It's not like they're going to have a lot of trouble packing the people in there. I think it would make for a great atmosphere. It sounds like they're just going to go right back to Chicago. If they run the Now Arena, that's even more ridiculous. If you're going to run Chicago, you may as well run the United Center. You're going to run the Now Arena that fits 10,000 people. They have outgrown that building. But I just think potentially doing the United Center back-to-back shows is just kind of ridiculous to me. Switchblade Jay White, still the IWGP Heavyweight Champion after an excellent match with a very underwhelming, very sudden finish. Adam Cole suffered what is said to have been a very serious concussion late in the match, which is why the finish came off so sudden and so flat the way that it did. Not only did he suffer a bad concussion, he has also been working with a torn labrum in his shoulder. And so if he's going to be out for any length of time with the concussion, and you never know how long someone might be out for when it comes to concussions, I agree with what Meltzer said in The Observer this week, that it would make sense for him to get his shoulder fixed. Even though that probably means an extended layoff, that is not a good injury to be working on. I think Kenny Omega worked the majority of, you know, before he lost the title to Hangman Page, he worked the majority of last year, I believe, with a tear in his labrum, among many other injuries that he was dealing with. Again, I just think it would be smart, get it fixed now, heal up, and then come back at 100%. FTR, they're the new IWGP Tag Team Champions. They now are the IWGP Champs, the Ring of Honor Tag Team Champs, and the AAA Tag Team Champs. Yeah, the stage is set for the inevitable showdown with the Young Bucks. They could do it All Out. Winner take all, put all the gold on the line. Build the matches, who is the best tag team in the world? Then you put the AEW belts on FTR. Pac is the first ever All-Atlantic champion. He won that four-way match against Malakai Black, Miro, and Clark Connors. And they've already announced that Pac is going to defend the All-Atlantic title, his first title defense. It's coming up at a Rev Pro show. So this is how they're going to go about things with this All-Atlantic title, which is kind of what I was hoping they would do. You know, really make it an international title and have the champion defend it in other promotions. And that is what he is going to do. He is going to defend that title at a Rev Pro show against Shota Umino. We had the AEW debut of Claudio Castagnoli, who got a monster pop in Chicago, and not only was he the perfect opponent for Zack Sabre Jr., not named Bryan Danielson, but also the perfect addition to the Blackpool Combat Club. He fits like a glove. And I said, if it was anybody else going into this show, who was unveiled as the mystery opponent, it would have been a disappointment. and they did not disappoint. What's funny about how it all came together is that Tony Khan had already signed Claudio. He already had him under contract. Tony picked up the phone. He called him the day after their Los Angeles debut at the beginning of June. And he had two plans for how to debut him in AEW. The main plan had been to debut him at the Ring of Honor Death Before Dishonor pay-per-view that AEW announced this week for July 23rd. And if you remember what I've been pitching for a while now, my idea was for Tony Khan to sign him and make him one of the top stars on the Ring of Honor brand. Maybe even make him Ring of Honor World Champion. So he was thinking along the same lines that I was. Then the injury happened to Bryan Danielson. And Tony had a phone conversation with Danielson while AEW was in St. Louis for Dynamite. And at first, Bryan said, oh, I feel great. I'm good. You know, they were hoping he would be back in time for the Forbidden Door show. But then later on in the conversation, I don't know what happened, but he apparently wavered and said, you know what, I'm not feeling 100%. And if Bryan Danielson is telling you, you know what, I don't feel 100%, then you know he doesn't feel 100%. So once Tony Khan heard that, he didn't even flinch. I mean, he didn't even want to take the chance of putting him back in the ring too soon. And Bryan happened to mention Claudio's name. He pitched Claudio as his replacement. And Tony Khan said to him, it's funny you should say that, because I have Claudio under contract. I just haven't told anybody yet. You're the first person I've mentioned it to. So I think that's going to work out real nice for all of us. I like the idea that Tony Khan just has everybody who's not currently under contract to WWE. They're just under contract right now. He just immediately signed them, just so he knows in his mind, I've got them under contract. There's some kind of underground bunker, and all of these people are just kind of hiding out down there. Bray Wyatt maybe is hiding out down there. All these people are hiding out down there in this underground bunker. They're all under contract. And as soon as somebody goes down with an injury or there's a need for it, all Tony Khan has to do is pick up the phone. It's like the manager or the coach calling to the bullpen. All right, we need you. So that's what he effectively did with Claudio. So Bryan did legitimately handpick him to be his replacement, just like he said he did on TV. But he picked him not even knowing that Tony Khan had already signed him. And in the end, it worked out perfectly, and they still have the match they can come back to when Danielson is all healed up and feeling better. There is still the Bryan Danielson-Zack Sabre Jr. match that they can do, whether it's in AEW or whether it's in New Japan. I think it'll end up happening in Japan. Now, AEW followed that up on Wednesday with the Blood and Guts episode of Dynamite from Detroit, their debut in that market. They had over 13,000 people in the building. They were also back over 1 million live viewers for the first time since March, which TBS was very quick to issue a press release for, that it was number one on cable for the second straight week. First show, post Forbidden Door, and they're back over 1 million. It was, however, lower than what last year's Blood and Guts show did, lower by almost 20% in the key demo. But they devoted the entire second hour of that show on Wednesday to Blood and Guts, which was as advertised. It was violent, it was chaotic, it was bloody. No guts, though. Second year in a row, we didn't get any guts. I feel lied to. There were no actual guts spilled all over the mat. But what a week for Claudio. Between the debut on Sunday, then he starts the Blood and Guts match for his team. It was him and Sammy Guevara. They started out for their respective teams. He's in there wrecking Sammy. He's wrecking people. He ends the match, giving Chris Jericho a giant swing on top of the cage before submitting Matt Menard in the sharpshooter to win the match for his team. So Claudio came across like a bigger fucking star in 1 week in AEW than he did in 10 years working for WWE. One of the great shames of Vince McMahon was him in that interview with Steve Austin wondering if maybe him being Swiss might have something to do with why he can't make the connection and why he's being held back. I don't know, maybe he's Swiss. Well, he is Swiss, but he's saying maybe that's why. Maybe it's because he's Swiss. It had nothing to do with him being Swiss. And it had everything to do with Vincent Kennedy McMahon. That's in the past now. I am glad that he is getting a second lease on life. Now, unfortunately, there was an injury coming out of the Blood and Guts match, and that was to Santana. He got injured on a Uranage to Daniel Garcia. It was very early after Santana got into the ring for the Blood and Guts match. Just, you could see it on when you watch it back. I mean, the way he planted his leg, it looked nasty. It did not look good. And Brian Alvarez says that Santana was supposed to be going for an MRI to determine what, if any, damage had been done to his knee. It looks like a knee injury and not an ankle injury. But the latest on him is that he was going to have to undergo an MRI, and everybody was hoping for good news, but it looks like he's probably going to be out for a very long time, especially if it's an ACL injury. If it's an ACL injury, then he's gone for 6 to 9 months. Maybe longer. Look at Bailey. Bailey tore her ACL. She's been gone for a year. Hopefully it's not an ACL, but whatever it is, it did not look good. And Sean Ross Sapp had an interesting reply to a viewer on YouTube who asked if there is anything going on between Santana and Ortiz. And the person pointed out to Sean how, you know, they don't stand next to each other on screen when they do promos anymore. And on its own, I mean, that may be a little weird, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But Sapp also pointed out that Santana's been doing a lot more indie stuff on his own without Ortiz as a single. I went on Santana's Instagram. All of his photos only have him in it. There's no tag team pictures. There's nothing with him and Ortiz. Even the AEW stuff where they're both in the ring together, it's like Ortiz is cropped out of all of the photos. So you can't see him. You just see Santana. It is very strange. When Ortiz had his hair versus hair match with Chris Jericho a few weeks ago, it was Eddie Kingston in Ortiz's corner. There was no Santana out there with him. And they also have not had one regular tag team match together. And this I couldn't believe when I looked it up, but it's true. They have not had one regular two-on-two tag team match together since February. You have to go all the way back to a Dynamite match against Chris Jericho and Jake Hager to find the last Proud and Powerful match that was not a multi-man match like a Battle Royal or an Anarchy in the Arena or something like that, or Blood and Guts. You know, some big multi-man match like that. It's hard to believe that it's been that long. I thought once they left the Inner Circle, we were finally going to be in store for a Santana and Ortiz push towards the tag team titles. They haven't even wrestled together in over 4 months in a regular tag team match. So it would be a shame if they had some kind of falling out in real life. And this is all speculation. Nobody knows for sure, but it looks like there's some smoke to the fire. It looks like there's something going on there. And that would be a shame, but I've said before, I think Santana has a singles run in him. Apparently he feels the same way. Now maybe that run comes in AEW, maybe it doesn't, because now there's talk that when his contract is up, which could be in the next few months, he might potentially be gone. He could potentially be leaving AEW. But this guy's out there now, he's winning singles titles on the indies. It's a shame that he and Ortiz never got a run with the AEW tag team titles. And now it appears that they may not ever get that run. We had heel Christian Cage, and now what appears to be heel Luchasaurus. Christian has been one of the more enjoyable parts of Dynamite, to be honest with you. I'm loving the Christian Cage heel turn in the promos so far, and we had a heel version of Luchasaurus with a black mask, you know, laying waste to, I think it was Fuego del Sol on TV on Wednesday. So Jungle Boy is out with a shoulder injury. I don't know how serious it is. I don't know when he'll be back. But while he's licking his wounds, we have heel Luchasaurus now on TV. Orange Cassidy is once again using the song Jane by Jefferson Starship as his new theme music. That was the theme he used on the Independence before he came to AEW. Tony Khan has secured the rights, and he debuted it on TV on Wednesday for his match with Ethan Page. And I will say it again, I think it is a much better entrance song than Where Is My Mind. That is the hill that I choose to die on. You can join me on that hill, or you can wave to me from another hill, but that's what I believe, and you're not going to change my mind. Now, on Friday night, they had a Royal Rampage match. 20 men, two rings, entering at 1 minute intervals to determine who would be Jon Moxley's first challenger for the interim AEW World title. I was not expecting the finish that we got in that match. Brody King, Darby Allin, came down to the two of them, and Brody King dumped out Darby to win the entire thing. I'm actually glad they threw a bone to the House of Black because they really needed that win. Now, they're not going to get the win on Wednesday when he challenges Moxley. He's not winning the championship, nor should he, but at least it's a bone that they can throw to the House of Black at a time when the House of Black is not really doing much. Buddy Matthews is out with an injury. I think he may have a shoulder injury of some kind. Malakai did not win the All-Atlantic title at Forbidden Door. At least Brody King is winning something. And it could be, possibly, maybe, potentially, a small little seed planted or a small little tease this Wednesday for what could eventually be a trios match with the House of Black once everybody is all healed up against the Blackpool Combat Club. We could eventually be getting Jon Moxley, Brian Danielson, and Claudio against Malakai, Buddy Matthews, and Brody King. And what a fucking match that would be. First, we got to get back Brian Danielson and Buddy Matthews. But once they come back, that's a trios match that I would love to see. So, sign me up for that. There was too much going on, I thought, between the two rings to really follow everything that was going on in that match on Friday. And, you know, I said, I'm not a big fan of the old World War III three-ring circus that WCW used to do back in the day. I didn't like that either because there was just way too much going on. You couldn't follow it all. You couldn't follow all the eliminations. And that's kind of how I felt about this match too. But as Battle Royals go, it was better than the one we got on SmackDown. But I still didn't think it was anything to really sing home about. The Rita Chatterton story was back in the news this week after New York Magazine did a story on the accusation that she made many years ago against Vince McMahon, that he allegedly sexually assaulted her in the backseat of his limousine in 1986. The piece was written by Abe Reisman, who is the author of the upcoming unauthorized Vince McMahon biography, which is due to be published right before next year's WrestleMania, and is going to have to be rewritten now with the news of this investigation by the WWE Board of Directors. At least the ending is going to have to be. Imagine working on a Vince McMahon book or a Vince McMahon biopic, right? Because isn't Netflix working on something like that? Imagine working on that, and then this story breaks a few weeks ago about the investigation. Just if you're like a director on this, you got to be thinking, fuck. If you're the author or the director or whatever, you got to be thinking, you got to be fucking shitting me now, man. I gotta junk this whole thing, or I gotta change the entire ending. I have to wait for the investigation to finish and see what the outcome is. That's got to be a pain in the ass. I've mentioned Chatterton's name before. She went by the name Rita Marie as the first ever female referee in WWE history back in the 80s. She was interviewed for the article. She hasn't talked about this in many, many years, decades. She has not talked about this. But she was interviewed for the article, and probably the first comments about it that she has made since she went public with the allegations in 1992 on Geraldo Rivera's old show. But she claims that she was sold on this idea, this vision by Vince, that as the first female referee, we're going to get you on the cover of Time magazine and all these different magazines, and you're going to get a contract for $500,000, which is preposterous to even think about back then, especially any referee getting that much money. But she didn't know that. She bought into what he was selling, right? He's a salesman. He's a promoter. And according to her, she bought into, you know, what he was pitching her. And I'm not going to get into all the gory details about the story. I mean, the story itself does a good job of that. She didn't want to get into any of those details. So the story uses details from when she first talked about the alleged incident many years ago. In this updated interview with her, she really didn't want to get into any of the specifics, but they do a good job in the story of recapping exactly what she claims happened in that limo and, you know, basically Vince telling her that if you don't do certain things in the backseat of this limo, that you're not going to get that contract. And after they were done, he supposedly reminded her of something that he had told her when she first started working for him, which was, don't ever get involved with any of the boys. Stay away from the boys. They're off limits. No relationships, no relations. When they were done in the limo, she claims that he asked her, "You remember what I told you when you first started working for me? Not to get involved with any of the boys? Well, you just did." And she never did get that big contract that she claims that she was promised. What's different about the story in the New York, not the New Yorker, in New York Magazine, is that for the first time there is another wrestler on the record backing her claims up. Somebody who claims it at the time when the incident supposedly happened, she came to him and he knew how upset she was. And that is former enhancement talent Mario Mancini, who did a lot of, you know, jobs and enhancement work for WWF back in the day. He believes that she was taken advantage of that night. None of this is going to go anywhere. And the story did not get much traction after the first day or two that it was published. But it does not paint Vince McMahon in the best light. Another article that was published this week that does not paint somebody in the best light is the Sports Illustrated expose by Greg Oliver on the late Rocky Johnson and all of the children that he fathered while touring the U.S. and Canada during his wrestling heyday. Five of them that we know of. He was very busy on the road. Five kids that we know of outside of The Rock. None of them were ever publicly acknowledged by Johnson, but they have all come together to try to make up for lost time and learn more about their half-brothers and sisters. And according to the article, in some cases, Rocky Johnson would hang up on one of the daughters every time she would call, trying to connect with him over the years. He would just hang up on her, wouldn't even talk to her. With some of the other children, he would speak on the phone to them. He would promise to visit, and then, of course, he never actually did. Following his death is when the children, who are, they're now all grown adults, that's when they started to really connect with each other. And all of the children, they have confirmed that he is their father through DNA ancestry websites. The Rock has not publicly commented on any of this. And the story noted that he has not yet privately responded to his half-siblings. And they all make it very clear in the piece. Nobody is trying to go after The Rock or wants The Rock's money or wants to be friends with The Rock or blame The Rock. The Rock has nothing to do with any of this. He's not responsible for his father's decisions, especially given the fact that he probably never even knew they existed. But Rocky Johnson's brother Ricky is interviewed in the piece. He teamed with Rocky in Hawaii as part of, they were a tag team for a while, and there were times over the years, even into the early 2000s, where they were on good terms, but then they weren't on good terms. Ricky has welcomed all of these kids as his nieces and nephews. He has embraced all of them. And he reminds me of Brian Pillman's sister in the Dark Side of the Ring episode on Pillman. She was the glue that held that family together with all the kids after he passed away. I mean, that woman is like a godsend to Brian's kids. That's how Rocky's brother, Ricky, comes across in this piece. He was more of a father figure to these people than his brother ever was. You know, there's other skeletons in Rocky Johnson's closet if you read up on him. I don't need to get into them here, but it was an interesting story. I would give it a read if you've got a few minutes. They're not looking for any kind of fame or relationship with The Rock. Again, nothing like that. It's just, it's hard for them to reconcile how this man, their father, could abandon them and not want to have anything to do with them. And now that they have become aware of how many of them there are, and they're still searching, they're still thinking that there might be more of them out there, it's nice to see them all becoming friends and trying to be part of each other's lives. Logan Paul signed a contract with WWE this week. He put the photo online of him at WWE headquarters with Triple H and Stephanie, putting pen to paper. Ariel Helwani reports that his contract is a multi-year deal to compete at multiple events per year. It includes Paul appearing at an undisclosed number of WWE pay-per-views across 2022 and 2023, and they have already started teasing a match with him against The Miz at SummerSlam. He is scheduled to appear on the July 18th episode of Monday Night Raw in Tampa to build up the match. On Raw Monday night, The Miz first said that he and Paul would reunite their tag team at SummerSlam, and that him attacking Paul and laying him out with the skull-crushing finale at WrestleMania was a teaching lesson for him. I guess it was a teachable moment stealing Andre Chase's gimmick now from NXT. But Logan Paul, when he signed his contract, he made it very clear he wanted nothing to do with The Miz and that he signed his contract so that he could beat The Miz's ass at SummerSlam. And The Miz is going to respond to his comments and his challenge on Raw tomorrow night. You know, look, I pay respect to the Paul brothers for parlaying their YouTube fame into legitimate careers in boxing and now wrestling. Legitimate in that they're making real money. I'm sure Logan Paul isn't making peanuts. He went to WrestleMania, and I didn't know what to expect from him in the ring. And he had one of the best celebrity performances that I've ever seen. You know, for someone who never had a match before. He went in there, he looked the part, he's got size. He didn't embarrass himself. He had a very good showing, and because of that, I don't have an issue with him coming back and doing more. I question making him a babyface because it looks like he'll be booked as a babyface in his match with The Miz. I think that's going to be an uphill battle because he's a natural heel. Walking out of WrestleMania with a $5 million Pokemon card around his neck, the guy's a fucking heel. And he got booed live in the building last night at Money in the Bank when they showed him on screen. I had people in the building say, man, they booed Logan Paul. So it's going to be an uphill battle if they want him to be a babyface. It kind of reminds me of when they tried to do that with Floyd Mayweather many years ago, and it didn't work out then either in his feud with Big Show. But he's signed to a deal. I won't call it a full-time deal because I doubt that it truly is full-time. I don't see him on weekly TV and house shows and doing stuff like that. But he's committing to it, and he looks like he's taking it seriously. But I have to say, you know, it is kind of sad. They used to bring in celebrities to help give the rub to their existing stars. They would bring them in to help elevate their current talent. The way they use Mike Tyson and Steve Austin is a prime example. And now, today, you know, we saw it with Bad Bunny at WrestleMania last year. When they teamed him up with Damian Priest, it was a great spot for Priest to be in. At least it got him on the WrestleMania card. Damian Priest wasn't even going to be on the WrestleMania card, were it not for that match. And he could speak Spanish, so they paired him up with Bad Bunny. But when that match was over, nobody was talking about Damian Priest. Everybody was talking about Bad Bunny and how he blew away everyone's expectations. Oh my God, he did a Canadian destroyer. Put him in the fucking Hall of Fame. In hindsight, that did nothing for Damian Priest, but it's not about that anymore in WWE. It's not about using those celebrities to get their talent over. It's about bringing the celebrities in to get the celebrities over. And if they're lucky, they'll get them to come back and they get to do it again. Bad Bunny's going to be back. He's talked about wanting to come back. And if I'm WWE, I want him back because Bad Bunny is legitimately one of the biggest stars in the world. So it's not like I can find fault with WWE wanting to do business with someone like Bad Bunny. But the celebrities are the stars because they forgot how to make stars of their own. So now when they bring these people in, that they are the stars. And that's it, because this is a company that has forgotten how to make stars on their own. Logan Paul, it's the same thing. Now they're just giving them contracts. And they come in and they show they can do what all the other wrestlers do. In some cases, better than the wrestlers themselves. Pat McAfee. It's the same thing. They bring these people in. They have them doing moves that aren't supposed to look so easy. And they come in and they make it look like anybody can do this shit. And it never used to be that way. Bad Bunny comes in, does all these moves that an outsider shouldn't be able to do. Pat McAfee looks like he's been doing this for years. Logan Paul, same thing. I mean, why recruit from colleges or from the indie scene anymore when you can just bring these guys in? It's just the way things are now. But Logan Paul definitely has an aptitude for this. He seems to get it, and he can bring them a ton of views online. They said the one photo of him that they posted on the WWE Instagram page already has more views than any single photo in the history of their Instagram account. Now they have to hope that that can translate into ticket sales and box office. Otherwise, who gives a fuck about Instagram views? Can it translate into real business? People used to say the same thing about Ronda Rousey, but now Ronda just feels like any other person on the roster. Ronda Rousey doesn't feel special anymore. Ronda Rousey is another face on the roster. How long before Logan Paul doesn't feel special anymore? The key is going to be not overexposing him. Jeff Hardy, who checked into rehab for alcohol addiction back on June 21st, after being suspended without pay by AEW following his felony DUI arrest, filed a written plea of not guilty on Tuesday in response to that arrest. He faces potentially up to 5 years in prison if convicted. As for why he would plead not guilty with so much evidence against him, including video evidence and the results of his breathalyzer, which registered a blood alcohol content of more than 3.5 times the legal limit in the state of Florida. Why would he do that? Why would he plead not guilty? Because it's standard to plead not guilty. Everybody who is complaining about this week, this is much ado about nothing. It does not mean that Jeff Hardy is trying to avoid responsibility for what he did. It's a tactic that simply buys him more time. It allows his lawyer more time to review his case and to explore his options, or they could try to cut a deal. But I saw a lot of outrage on social media about this. It's not that big of a deal. And it's to be expected that he would have pled that way. That's what his lawyer would have told him to do. Question is he going to actually do time this time for what he did? I think he should. But his lawyer is going to do everything in his power to make sure that doesn't happen. One person who wishes they had a lawyer who was going to do everything in their power to keep them out of jail is Tammy Sitch. The tale of Tammy continues. She lost her lawyer last week when he asked the court to allow him to step away as her counsel, and the court agreed. They granted his request because she's a fucking nutcase. Tammy then filed a petition with the court on Thursday seeking to be granted criminal indigent status, meaning that because she is without sufficient income to afford a lawyer for her defense, she is requesting a public defender, which she has since been granted. She is facing one count of DUI manslaughter, which is a felony, one count of causing death while operating a vehicle with a suspended or revoked license, also a felony, four counts of DUI causing injury to a person, and three counts of DUI causing damage to property. In her petition, Sitch stated that she has just $2,500 in bank accounts, she has zero income, and has total liabilities and debts totaling $28,000, much of which I think is unpaid legal fees in other states, in other cases. So this is what she's claiming. This from a woman who only a couple of years ago claimed that she was in the top 1.8% of all creators on OnlyFans. I guess OnlyFans doesn't pay what it used to. But that's not all. There was a story in the Daytona Beach News Journal this week about the judge in the case warning Tammy's boyfriend about his behavior and threatening to hold him in contempt of court after he insulted the prosecutor. So on Thursday, the judge asked the assistant state attorney, Ashley Terwilliger, if James Pente, Tammy's boyfriend, had approached her that morning. And Terwilliger said, well, he didn't approach me, but he spoke to me, not surprisingly, as I was passing by. What did he say? The judge asked. And Terwilliger said he called me a dirty expletive. They didn't say exactly what the word, there's about three or four words that could have been in there. I don't know what the word was. But he called her a dirty blank, among other things that I did not fully catch. And the judge told Sitch to relay a message to her potty mouth boyfriend about his behavior. He said, so you understand, ma'am, if you want him to be present in court, this kind of behavior is absolutely unacceptable, and I will not allow him to be present if he is going to disrupt proceedings or be inappropriate or unprofessional or threatening in any manner. So if you talk to him, you let him know that this could rise to the level of contempt of court, and if he were to do something like that, I would go into proceedings to see if I would sanction him for his behavior at the courthouse. Tammy's next hearing is set for August 11th. Maybe her boyfriend can share a cell next to her if he keeps spouting off like that. Then he wouldn't have to worry about making any conjugal visits. He'd be right there. And here's a crazy story involving NWA star and current House of Glory women's champion Natalia Markova. After flying home from the recent NWA TV tapings, she realized that she had been robbed. She was flying with a fellow NWA star, Brian Idol, who goes by the name Mercurio. When they stepped off the plane, she realized that her purse was missing. And after having the airline double-check that, you know, to make sure it wasn't left on the plane, that's when she realized it was stolen. Idol asked Markova if she had AirPods in her purse, and she did. And because of that, they were able to use the Find My app from the App Store, which uses GPS to locate your device. They tracked the AirPods to a Walmart in Pinellas Park, Florida, 40 minutes away. They got to the store just as Markova received a fraud alert, a fraud text message on her phone that somebody was attempting to purchase a $700 TV using her credit card. Idol realized that that person must be at one of the cash registers, and he started looking around until he recognized the man who was also on their flight. He spotted him. And there's security footage of the incident. The NWA, I think, even shared it on their social media page. Idol can be seen confronting the man. He's got a face mask on, this guy. He confronts the man. The man then tries to flee. He tries to run away, and Idol chases after him. He left Markova's credit card sitting at the register. So he's trying to flee. Idol chases him down, tackles him to the ground. Police arrived after getting a phone call about a fight in the store. And according to the police report, after speaking with Idol and Markova and the thief, the man was placed under arrest. Idol told the arresting officer that as long as all of Markova's items were returned to her, she would not press charges against him. The man told them that the purse was turned into the American Airlines information desk at the airport, and then he admitted that he had taken $600 from the purse, as well as the credit cards and the AirPods inside, and he returned the stolen items to her. And Markova declined to press charges against the man, and the guy apologized for stealing the money and the cards, and he said he knew it was wrong, and he was later released after no active warrants for him were found, and the case is now considered closed. He may not be so lucky the next time he pulls a stunt like that. But I'm glad that she got all of her belongings back. Brian Idol, a real-life Batman. And now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. You know, burnout is real. It's not just a thing that you do with your car. I feel it, you feel it, we all feel it at some point. Even Batman feels it. I'm sure Batman's been burned out a time or two. Gotham can be a very depressing place, as we all know. You can be burned out without even knowing it. If you're more irritable than usual, I know that feeling. Doesn't mean that you're a jerk. You could simply be burned out. Same thing if you're feeling tired or unmotivated. BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you to prioritize yourself. Talking with somebody can help give you that kick in the butt that you need to figure out what's causing the stress in your life. Believe me, there's nothing wrong with accepting the fact that you do not have all the answers to your problems, and sometimes you just need to ask for help, which is why therapy is so helpful to so many people. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. That's BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. All Sound Off listeners, take advantage. Get 10% off now at BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. Monday was the Big John Cena 20th anniversary celebration that helped WWE sell an extra 4,000 tickets that they otherwise would not have sold. The last real needle mover. And it's not Roman Reigns. His name is John Cena. A lot of people, myself included, they were expecting this to be the kickoff to a Cena match at SummerSlam, likely a match with Austin Theory. And the two of them did share a backstage moment together where Theory ran down Cena. He went to go take a selfie, but there was nobody there. Well, Cena was there. He just couldn't see him. But that's all that we got. Otherwise, this was one big 20th birthday party for John Cena with testimonials from different wrestlers, airing throughout the show, the most notable three being from Chris Jericho, Daniel Bryan, and The Big Show. And that was as simple as WWE, and I think it was Bruce Pritchard, reaching out directly to Tony Khan for approval to have them send messages in, and Tony said, yes, it sounds like this is a nice thing that you're doing for John Cena. And he said, as long as they're okay with it, the wrestlers have to be okay with it, but if they're cool with it, then all the requests are approved. So a few weeks ago, we had AJ Styles sending in a 20th anniversary video to Impact for their Slammiversary pay-per-view, and now we get these AEW stars sending in their testimonials into Monday Night Raw. It was nice to see. Mark Henry did a video too, but for whatever reason, that didn't air. Maybe he filmed his testimonial on a potato, and the video quality was not up to snuff, I don't know, but his is the only one that didn't air. Vince McMahon made yet another appearance. This was his third on television since stepping aside as CEO and chairman. We're seeing him more now than we have in years. The guy steps aside and we're seeing him more now than ever. He came out to introduce John Cena, who walked out wearing his new t-shirt, which is a play off of the original WrestleMania game for the NES, which was, I believe, the first WWF game for Nintendo, for the main system. It was the first wrestling game that I ever played, and it was the shits. I remember Bam Bam Bigelow doing cartwheels every 5 seconds. He didn't say much that we have not heard him say before. He was very humble. He thanked the fans. He said he was 45 years old. Time for his colonoscopy. No, he didn't say that. But it is time. He is at that age. He said he doesn't know when we're going to see him in the ring again. There was a one more match chant, which he cut off, and he said it wouldn't be just one. That was an important line. He made it very clear when he comes back, he's not just coming back for a one shot. He's not saying it won't happen, he just doesn't know when that's going to be. I would think July 30th in Nashville would be a pretty good guess. He said when he did return, it wouldn't be about him, it would be about us. And that was it. And the crowd loved him, but it was underwhelming that they didn't shoot some kind of an angle. You know, maybe they figured since Money in the Bank was this weekend and Theory's already got a match to promote against Bobby Lashley, you know, why do anything now? I mean, look, that didn't stop them from shooting an angle with Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns to set up the SummerSlam main event. But I am wondering if maybe he's not going to be at SummerSlam. Maybe the plan is for him to be at WrestleMania instead. We are going to have our answer by next Monday. For sure. By next Monday, we're going to know whether or not John Cena is on the show or not. That's the July 11th episode of Raw. If there is no mention of Cena by that show, then he's not going to be on the SummerSlam card. I'm convinced of this. Because if he was going to be on that card, they would want to advertise him for it, and they would want to sell as many tickets as they can. Look at all the tickets he pushed to Raw last Monday. Now they have a stadium to fill. You don't think they want to announce John Cena if he's going to be on the show? Make sure they announce him with plenty of time. You start moving more tickets. So I don't think we're going to have to wait that long for an answer. Had we not already seen Cena back on TV less than a year ago, even a simple hi and goodbye like this I think would have been fine. But it definitely felt underwhelming when it was over and nothing came of it. But the subject of John Cena as the greatest of all time has come up again since they have been calling him that on TV going back to last year. That's their new tagline for him. He is the greatest of all time. That's what WWE calls him. That's how they refer to him on TV. Vince McMahon called him that again on Monday. The greatest of all time. It is a completely subjective thing. As time has gone on, I have come to appreciate John Cena more than I did when he was still active full-time. And I think a lot of people are in the same camp. I'm far from the only one who feels like this. I didn't hate John Cena. There are people who absolutely hated John Cena. And probably still do. But if you would have asked me that question years ago, I would have laughed in your face. But as time has gone on, I have come to appreciate, maybe now because we don't get to see him very often, to appreciate what he brought to the table. Many times over the years, I have defended John Cena on my show as a worker because I still think he gets a lot of unfair criticism for not being a good wrestler when he has actually had a ton of excellent, memorable matches in his career. his body of work speaks for itself. But when you're as over as John Cena is, I don't want to say work rate doesn't matter at all, but, you know, how many moves you can do and how good they look, that doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter as much. The fact is, the guy was and still is super over with the audience. He's larger than life. He has had greater longevity than most, and he is probably the greatest spokesperson and role model outside of the ring that this company has ever had. I mean, Titus O'Neil is up there too, but I'm talking about in terms of real top talent. There's nobody better in that respect than John Cena. I absolutely agree that John Cena is the greatest of all time when it comes to that, especially all the Make-A-Wish stuff that he's done. I mean, there has never been a top star in WWE history who is a greater representative for the company and just as good of a human being, a great humanitarian, as John Cena. Mick Foley is up there with him, but Cena is the best. I mean, he's the high watermark in this company. You know, so many of the biggest names that have worked for that company have been tainted in some way or have had their name attached to some sort of scandal. Cena is one of the few who never embarrassed WWE. They were very fortunate to have somebody like him that they could put on their posters and they can send out to do media interviews. You can see why Vince McMahon loved having him as his top guy. He never wanted to turn him heel, even though there were opportunities to do it, and Cena himself wanted to do it at one point. And there were plans for it. But Vince got cold feet. He didn't even want to broach the subject from that point on. It would have made for better television, and it would have opened him up to new opponents, and it would have freshened the character up, but in hindsight, I can understand why they never did it. You know, where does Cena rank all time, though? He's in the conversation, but he is not the greatest of all time. He is not the greatest wrestler of all time in WWE or just in general. He's not on my Mount Rushmore. But again, it is a subjective thing. For all the good that Cena has done, there were also a lot of fans who stopped watching during the Cena era, who were turned off by him in the way that he was booked. Or maybe they held it against him because it wasn't the Attitude Era anymore, and Cena represented the antithesis of what they grew up watching and having fun with people like Stone Cold and The Rock. You know, for all the merch that he's sold, and he sold a lot of t-shirts, I'm reminded of Randy Orton many years ago responding to a fan who pointed out to him that WWE was only selling kids' t-shirts with John Cena branding on them at some of the live events. I think it might have been on a European tour. This is when Cena was outselling everybody else, and people were always saying, oh, John Cena sells more merch than everybody else. He's the biggest merch seller in the company. And Orton responded and said, you know, that's a great point. He didn't argue what this fan was saying. I mean, it's not that hard to outsell everybody else when 80% or 90% of the shirts at the merch stands belongs to one person. And the rest of them have to fight for the other 20%. Now, Cena's always been popular with the kids. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense to stock up on extra Cena shirts, but how do you think it made the other talent feel to see that and not see their own merch? How are you supposed to compete with John Cena and try to outsell him when most of the shit they're putting out for sale belongs to one person? So, I mean, there's been a lot of stories like that over the years, and that's where some of the Cena hate comes from. When they first moved him to Monday Night Raw and they started pushing him, they were pushing him. I mean, they were pushing him hard down people's throats, whether they liked it or not. And the fans began to rebel. That was not the case when he was the Doctor of Thugonomics on SmackDown. That only started when he got drafted to Raw in 2005. And on that note, there was one tweet that bothered me on Monday when I saw it. All the wrestlers and all the WWE employees and former employees and writers and people were posting very nice messages and thank you messages to John Cena. And that's all very nice. But there was one tweet that really got under my skin. It was from former WWE head writer. This is not just some random person. Former head writer for a decade in WWE, Brian Gewirtz. He said, do you remember that time that our top babyface was booed mercilessly by thousands of people every night for a solid 8 years because he was, I don't know, kind of nice to children? Congrats on 20 incredible years, John Cena, the genuine article. That really aggravated the shit out of me when I read that, because he was either being completely ignorant or completely dishonest when he posted that. I mean, it is typical WWE revisionist history. Gewirtz spent over a decade working as a writer for Vince McMahon. He was in the inner circle for a long time. He was in the bubble. If that's what they honestly believe, then there is a willful ignorance there that is even worse than I thought. The majority of those fans did not boo John Cena and chant "Cena sucks" because he was nice to children. That is a stupid fucking thing to say. They booed him because when he got drafted to Raw, they changed him. It wasn't the same John Cena that we saw on SmackDown. They also probably pushed him too hard, too fast. Which goes to what I was just talking about with Austin Theory and why WWE has to be very careful if they plan on not only giving him money in the bank, but putting the championship on him very soon. It could end up blowing up in their face. There is such a thing as too much, too soon. And I think that was a big part of it also with John Cena. He wasn't very good in the ring, not as good as he would get later on. So here's the new top champion on Raw, right? He just got drafted. And if you go back and you watch his work at the time in 05, even the night that he got drafted, the guy had two left feet. He wasn't very good. He didn't have to go out there and work like Bret Hart, but it was noticeable how much of a step down from people like Shawn Michaels and Triple H and Chris Benoit that he was. There was a feeling that he didn't, you know, deserve it. He hadn't earned the spot. And some people began to resent him for it. That's where some of the boos came from. There were others on the roster that fans liked, and Cena was beating them all. And that's always going to upset people. The idea that John Cena was burying people, and I hate to even use that word, I think the Cena burying people idea was overplayed. You ask people, you know, who did John Cena bury? And they end up throwing out names like Umaga and Damian Sandow. Umaga was the savage heel who was there to be beaten by somebody like John Cena. It's just like Rusev many years later, the evil Bulgarian, right? In 2015, WrestleMania, Cena handed him his very first defeat. He won the U.S. title. It was always meant to end that way. The evil foreign menace beaten by the American hero. Now, Sandow, I agree they could have done more with him, but he was never going to be the world champion. Some people are just not going to be the world champion and should not be in that spot. The Nexus is a different story. Even Cena himself admits, or he admitted later on to Chris Jericho and Edge, that after that SummerSlam main event in 2010, it was a mistake to book that match and book that finish the way they did. The Super Cena booking absolutely buried the Nexus that year. And they still had a lot of mileage in them, but they never recovered from that. That was a mistake. But the point is, there are a lot of different reasons that you can point to why people booed John Cena. They booed him in 2011 against CM Punk because they like CM Punk more. They booed him against The Rock because they liked The Rock more. And Cena had made dumb comments about him leaving for Hollywood and abandoning his WWE fans. He was only saying what Vince McMahon wanted him to say, and he got heat for it. And now he sings a very different tune, and he's apologized to The Rock for ever saying that, because now he's doing the same thing. He's making a name for himself in Hollywood. Pick whatever reason you want. There's plenty to choose from, but for Gewirtz to pretend like he has no idea why all the mean wrestling fans booed John Cena for so many years, and to say, well, I guess it was just because he was nice to little kids, that is one of the dumbest fucking things that I have heard in a very long time. Coming from someone who was probably at least partially responsible for why John Cena was booed so heavily in the first place. But when you're in the WWE bubble, it's only natural to not take responsibility for anything being your fault, and just shift all the blame onto the fans. Right? Why look in the mirror when you can just blame the fans for everything? John Cena has been part of some of the best matches in WWE history. The Judgment Day I Quit match with JBL. I think that was his first truly great match. The TLC match in Toronto with Edge at Unforgiven. The Last Man Standing match at the Royal Rumble with Umaga. That 55-minute match he had on Raw in the UK with Shawn Michaels. Money in the Bank with CM Punk, one of my favorite matches of all time. That first WrestleMania match in Miami with The Rock that did big business. The Extreme Rules match with Brock Lesnar when Brock first came back to the company. That was such a different kind of match. It was such a unique match. It was great. The SummerSlam match with Daniel Bryan, one of the greatest babyface matches in company history. The Royal Rumble triple threat with Brock Lesnar and Seth Rollins. The series of matches that he had with AJ Styles. You cannot ever say that John Cena did not know how to work or that he couldn't wrestle. He could wrestle just fine. He was not the best wrestler, but he could wrestle just fine. And he's got the resume to back it up. He is the last real star that that company may have ever had and may have ever produced. Cena is a wonderful ambassador for WWE. You know, in a business that has traditionally had a lot of very scummy people in it, and that has a real dark underbelly, John Cena stands out as somebody to hold up as a model for others. And he has my respect. I think time will be even kinder to him as the years go by. But is he the greatest of all time? I don't think John Cena has ever been the best at any one thing. At his peak, he was never the draw that Austin was when Austin was white hot at his peak. But Austin also had less time on top than John Cena did. Much less time. He was never the in-ring worker that a Bret Hart or a Shawn Michaels or a Randy Savage or a Ric Flair were. But he still had memorable matches. He can talk on the mic, but is he the best promo of all time? No, he's not. That's why I say, jack of all trades, master of none. I cannot rank him ahead of Hulk Hogan or Steve Austin, as far as how important they were. Frankly, I don't think I can't put him past Hogan, Austin, Flair. I mean, there's a bunch of people who I would rank ahead of John Cena. But I do think he is in the conversation. And I don't know that I would have said that 5 years ago. In fact, I know I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago. I think it's also a generational thing. If you grew up on John Cena, if you're a young fan, or if you only became a fan when John Cena was on top, then John Cena is probably your number one. He's probably the one that you hold in the highest regard. People say, what about Bruno? You're like, Bruno who? Hulk who? Right? So I think part of it also is a generational thing. But do I think he is the greatest of all time? No. Do I think he is in the conversation that you can make an argument for it? Yes. And I think that if you were to poll 10 people on who is on their Mount Rushmore and who they look at, and if we're just talking WWE in terms of greatest of all time, you probably would get 10 different answers. That's why it's so hard to really answer that question. But I do think he's in the conversation, and I do think time, you know, as the years go on, we'll end up being even kinder to John Cena. And we're going to look back and say, man, he was really the last of the real stars that WWE ever made. Let's take some of your questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We got Dan from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Are you surprised at all by how heavily AEW won over New Japan at Forbidden Door? I was expecting a fairly even record between the two companies, but we saw Moxley, Claudio, FTR, and Pac win their matches. Not counting matches where each side was a mix of AEW and New Japan wrestlers, Ospreay and Jay White were the only New Japan wrestlers to win the main card over AEW. Even on the buy-in, two of the three head-to-head matches went AEW's way. Any thoughts on why AEW went over so heavily against New Japan? I wouldn't say they went over heavily. I mean, it really didn't come across to me that way at all. Just looking at the main card, you had two world title matches. The one for the AEW title went to the AEW guy. And the one for the IWGP title went to one of the New Japan guys. You know, you take the next two biggest matches, and those broke evenly. It was Claudio's debut, so he had to win over Zack Sabre. He was going into Blood and Guts, not Zack Sabre. And Sabre is still going to wrestle Bryan Danielson at some point, possibly in Japan, and he'll probably win that match. The other was Will Ospreay and Orange Cassidy for the IWGP US belt, and Ospreay won. You know, the New Japan representative was never going to win the four-way for the All-Atlantic title, even if it was Ishii. If Ishii didn't get hurt and he was in that match, he wasn't going to win. But it was Clark Connors, and who the hell is Clark Connors to go in there and beat Pac Miro and Malakai Black? So that was never going to happen. FTR won the IWGP belts, which New Japan loves, because now it means they get FTR to come over at some point and work for them and defend their belts. All the other matches had both rosters mixed together. Darby, Sting, and Shingo, they won. Jericho, Sammy, and Minoru Suzuki, they won their match. I don't see that as AEW heavily beating New Japan at anything. You know, I thought on the whole it felt pretty even to me. You know, AEW won more matches on the pre-show, but can you even call Lance Archer an AEW guy at this point? The whole reason he even had a match on the buy-in in the first place was to promote the fact that he's in the G1 this month. So I think you're reading a little too much into it. Kevin from Sycamore, Illinois. Would you equate Sting's current run in AEW as the veteran willing to do just about anything to help the new company, much like Terry Funk did in ECW? Well, Terry Funk's run meant a lot more to ECW than Sting's run means to AEW, but I get what you're saying. You know, he's definitely willing to do whatever is asked of him. He is a team player. I think he's having the time of his life. I think he's just happy to have a place where he is allowed to actually work. He's cleared to work. And I'm sure that he is still making great money and he's able to go out there and be Sting for a few more years. You know, he knows that he's 63. He knows he's not going to be doing this when he's 73. So, you know, he doesn't know how many more years and how many more matches he's got left. He's able to go out there and get the kind of reactions and the respect that the talent gives him and the crowd gives him every time he goes out. He still gets to dress the part with the trench coat and the makeup. And the makeup helps, by the way, hide the age a little bit. And so he's loving life right now. You know, these are years that he probably never thought he would have when he was still with WWE because they were never going to let him work again. And he's been able to stay safe and stay healthy. And, you know, it's funny to me. Like now it's almost like he can't help himself. He's got to do some kind of dive at every match. So it is a little Terry Funk-esque, but, what Terry Funk meant to ECW was, far more important than what Sting means to AEW. John from Florida, I have two questions for you. Why did Vince turn Roman Reigns heel and not John Cena? Second question, how has the Lucha Libre style influenced the modern wrestling world, good and bad? He turned Roman Reigns because Roman Reigns, I think, basically demanded it. I think Roman has said that if Vince did not allow him to come back in the way that he did, then he wasn't going to come back. Or at least that's what he claims he told him. He had an idea in his head for how he wanted to come back and the type of character he wanted to be. And he drew a line in the sand and said, either this is how it is or I don't come back. You know, I've had a good career. But, you know, John Cena was still his biggest merch mover at the time, and I think he was just afraid. I think he was just scared. He didn't want to make the same mistake with John Cena that I think he probably remembers making with Steve Austin back in 2001. And maybe he was a little gun shy because of that. Maybe that played a role in it. You know, his past biggest star wanting to go heel, and then he acquiesced and said, okay, we'll turn you heel. And it ended up being a terrible business decision. We got some quality Austin segments during that heel run, but it, you know, business-wise, it was a terrible idea. And I think even Austin acknowledges the fact that it was a terrible idea. And you know it was a terrible idea because before that year was even over, he was already back to being a babyface. If his heel run was such a big success, Stone Cold would have still been a heel going into 2002. So I think that may have played a role in his thought process as well. How could it not? I can't ask him myself to know for sure, but you know, it's his company. He was there. He knows what happened when they turned Austin heel. How could that not play a role in his thinking? As far as the Lucha Libre style, I think it's influenced modern wrestling in a huge way. I mean, we see a lot of Lucha Libre influence on the shows, and, you know, a lot of the high-risk moves, I think, and, you know, dives and stuff like that. I think a lot of that is borrowed from stuff that we see in Lucha Libre, and there's good and bad that comes with that. I think it's pretty clear what the good and bad is. The bad is the more of that stuff we see, the more people get hurt. And I don't think that we need to be seeing stuff like that as often as we do. But also, it does make for a quicker pace. I think it makes for a more exciting product. I've tried to watch like a AAA show before, and it's not my thing. I can't get into it. See, Lucha Underground was perfect for me. Lucha Underground was like the perfect blend, I think, of Lucha Libre and, you know, the storytelling, the kind of the over-the-top storytelling and some of the gimmicks that they had. They managed to put the whole package together in a way that I thought was very entertaining. But if I sit here and try to watch a AAA show, I can't get into it. I think that, you know, the Lucha Libre style and all the the big moves and just transitioning from one big move to the next, we see a lot of that in AEW, and I'm not always a big fan of it in AEW either. So, you know, there's good and there's bad. You know, there's good and there's bad. There's a little bit of both. Neil from Chicago, was and is there heat on WWE's end about Tony Schiavone? I ask because I don't believe they have ever used him for any type of interviews or production for their DVD and network library. Is there a story of any heat with him and the company? No, there's no heat there. I mean, when he signed with AEW, he made some comments about, you know, never wanting to work there again. And I don't think his wife likes the company. There's, for whatever reason, I don't think his wife is very fond of WWE. But if I remember correctly, I mean, he was open to the idea of doing stuff like that on, you know, DVDs and production work and stuff like that. When he left the company in 1990, he left on good terms. You know, he only left, I think, because it had to do with his kids and the school situation. And it really was more about family. It wasn't that he didn't like it there. He had a blast working for WWE in 89 into 90. But, you know, having to move to Connecticut and everything, it just wasn't going to work. So when he left, there was no heat. They didn't part on bad terms. So no, I'm not aware of there being any pre-existing heat with him in the company. Daniel from Hamburg, what do you think would have happened if the Ultimate Warrior returned post-Screwjob in 1997? Vince McMahon apparently wanted him back at that time. Do you think there's a chance Warrior would have been in the main event at WrestleMania 14 against Shawn Michaels instead of Steve Austin? And if not, who would Warrior have worked with at WrestleMania? So what Daniel is referring to is a letter. And this letter first circulated, I think, a few years ago. But for whatever reason, things hit social media sometimes. And you never know when something is going to go viral and it just kind of takes off. And so this was the first time people knew about this. But there is a copy of a contract from Titan Sports. It was drawn up and written by Vince McMahon. He made an offer to the Ultimate Warrior in December of 1997 when Vince found out that WCW was trying to get the Warrior to sign with their company. He swooped in and made an offer himself. Now, you got to remember the timeline here, because there was a point in time in late 97 where WWE business was not doing well at all. Actually, in 97, I think, there was a point where they came close to filing for bankruptcy. So there were some lean times there, and it was September of 1997. It might have been at Madison Square Garden that night when Vince McMahon first went over to Bret Hart, who was his champion. He had just put the title on him at SummerSlam the month before, and he said, look, I can't afford to pay you on this contract. He wanted, I think, to try to like backload the contract or something, because Bret had this 20-year deal. And he wanted to pay him more at the end of the contract than at the beginning of the contract. And Bret said no, because of course, Bret would be a fucking idiot to say yes to that. I would have said no too. I said, no, you're going to pay me now. And Vince said, well, I'm going to breach your contract because I can't afford to pay you. And that's when he gave him permission. He actually encouraged him to start negotiating with Eric Bischoff and WCW to see if he can get a deal with their company. it was only about a month after that that Vince went back to Brett and said, hey, I can afford to pay you now. And Brett was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I already negotiated a deal. I've already signed a deal with Eric. It's done. I can't go back now. And Vince was like, oh, well, okay, I could afford to pay you now. And I think a lot of that had to do with them jacking up the price, $5 a month on their pay-per-views. They started with that In Your House show in September of 97, and they raised their pay-per-view prices, you know, to compete with what WCW was doing at the time. And, you know, on the one hand, you would think, well, that might cost them buys. It did just the opposite, and they actually made more money by raising their prices. And that had a lot to do with why all of a sudden Vince, you know, the numbers were always delayed, right? The pay-per-view numbers. But once he saw the numbers and he was like, oh, okay, well, guess what? Now I can afford to pay you. It was too late. But just this is all happening at a time. Things are so bad they can't even pay their champion. They're going to breach his contract intentionally and allow him to go walk into their competition because they cannot afford to pay him. Fast forward 3 months, and Vince McMahon puts this contract offer together for the Ultimate Warrior, offering him $750,000 a year and a net 35% on merchandise, which was above the usual percentage that was paid to WWF talents at the time. And the contract had a 14-day max per month on the road, so Warrior could not work or did not have to work more than 2 weeks each month. Okay, he got the same downside guarantee that people like Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker had, with the potential to make a hell of a lot more money than that. So, boy, yeah, business must have turned around real quick for him to turn around and make that kind of contract offer to the Ultimate Warrior. And it's a good thing things worked out the way that they did. Because had Warrior agreed to that deal, had he agreed and signed with the company, it would have been an absolute disaster. And within 6 months, I guarantee you, Vince McMahon would have been looking for ways to get out of that contract. He didn't want to breach Bret Hart's contract. He would have been looking for ways to breach the Ultimate Warrior's contract to get the fuck out of that thing. That would have been a disaster. Just look at how his run went in WCW in 98. You don't have to look at anything else other than that. It would have been about as successful as that. Who he would have wrestled at WrestleMania, I have no idea. Would he have gotten the spot against Shawn Michaels? I don't think so. Austin was already on the ascent. I would like to think that they wouldn't have, you know, sidetracked that push just to slot the Warrior in there. By December of 97, they were close enough to WrestleMania. They would have already had to have had their plans in place. Who knows, had he signed the contract, when he would have debuted? Maybe it would have been like WrestleMania 12, where they would have held off his debut until Mania, and he would have come back at Mania in some kind of a special attraction match against somebody. I don't have the foggiest idea who it would have been against. Undertaker and Kane, they had their own thing going. Austin still would have had his match with Shawn Michaels. But if Warrior would have come in, that would have been death for Stone Cold's run. That first title run, I mean, It would have been, I cannot put into words how much of a bullet they dodged and Austin dodged by Vince not signing Warrior, by Warrior not agreeing to that contract. That would have been a fucking disaster. Richie in Syosset, New York. It's no secret that storylines get dropped frequently in wrestling. Has there ever been a storyline that you were invested in that you thought could have been something great but was dropped? I don't know that I was really invested in them, but the Vince McMahon lockbox thing, that should have been expanded on after WrestleMania 32. I don't think they ever had any plan to follow up on it, but that could have been interesting. And Hideo Itami being laid out in the parking lot at Full Sail because, you know, he ended up being out with that injury for so long. So much longer than they thought. I think he was gone for like 18 months. It was never followed up on. He was attacked in the parking lot. Everybody thought it was Kevin Owens. It was kind of alluded to that it was probably Kevin Owens. But that was one of those storylines that just never was followed up on. And Jad from London, England. Given that WrestleMania 39 is in Hollywood next year, if the Hall of Fame class is not going to be headlined by The Rock, do you think it would be a good time to induct another legend-turned-Hollywood star in Batista? He was supposed to be inducted WrestleMania 36 weekend in 2020, but the pandemic stopped that from happening, and when they did the 2020 and 2021 inductions all at once a year later, he declined because he wanted his induction to be in front of actual people. What do you think, and who inducts him? If they can't get The Rock, then I think they headline with Batista. Undertaker was the other big name. And look, Triple H, now that we know Triple H is done, you could do Triple H and put Triple H in as a single, even though he's already in, I guess, as part of DX. But, you know, he'll get his own singular induction. I just don't know when he wants to go in. And so Batista would make sense. You could definitely, you know, headline with him as far as who inducts him. Triple H would make sense because Batista was one of the people that Triple H handpicked. Triple H and Randy Orton, Randy Orton and Batista, they were the two people that Triple H handpicked to be part of Evolution. If Batista is not part of Evolution, I don't know that he goes on to become a World Heavyweight Champion. He was the muscle of the group. He got to hang out with Triple H and Ric Flair and be in the spotlight. And he ended up getting the championship at a time when that wasn't even the original plan. The original plan for WrestleMania 21 was going to be Triple H and Randy Orton. And Batista just got over organically with the crowd. And it led to this huge push. And eventually Batista left. He went to Hollywood. Who knows if any of that happens? I don't know that Batista's in Guardians of the Galaxy and all of these things happen. If not for that first big push as part of Evolution. And he could thank Triple H for that. So, and he wanted Triple H to work with him. And he wanted to do the job for Triple H in his last match at WrestleMania 35. So it's very clear to me that if you give Batista the choice, he thinks the world of Triple H. I can't imagine he wants anybody else but Triple H to do the induction. So I think it would make sense for it to be him if Triple H himself is not going into the Hall of Fame. But Hollywood would make sense for The Rock. All comes down to his schedule, as it always does. You can email me your questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I will try to answer them. You never know when your question may pop up here on the podcast. You never know. Follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. Become a channel member on YouTube in the next few days, and you will be able to join us live on Wednesday at 1 o'clock Eastern for our next live watch-along, 25 years later. Canadian Stampede in your house. 10-man tag team main event. You've never seen a building shake before like it shook here in this match. So that's going to be a lot of fun, and keep taking advantage of that Audible offer. A lot of you have been listening to the Moxley book for free. audibletrial.com/solomonster. That link is still active. You can still get that book for free and hear John Moxley in his own words on his life and his career and what he really thinks of Kevin Dunn. I'm going to see you next Sunday for episode 764 of the podcast. I want to thank you for joining me for Money in the Bank last night. It was fun hanging out with everybody. And we'll be live for Dynamite and SmackDown and all the usual stuff this week on the YouTube channel. So be sure to sub over there. Be well. Stay safe. If you are stateside and you are celebrating, enjoy the day off. Enjoy July 4th tomorrow. Spend it with friends and family. I'm going to spend it still trying to recover from this ridiculous virus. And I will see you for 764 next Sunday. So until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
After the match, Shanky, he danced with Samantha Irvin at ringside. And Samantha Irvin has a big smile on her face, and she gets up and she starts dancing. Everybody's dancing. I wish they would take the writers of this show and they would take Vince and Bruce and lock them in a fucking room. Let Shanky book the show. It'll just be the dance-offs up and down the card. We'll have Walter. Let's have Gunther go out there and he can dance. Every match, right? We'll have the Usos dancing. We'll have Roman Reigns dancing. We'll have Riddle dancing. Pat McAfee's up on the announce desk. He's always dancing. Michael Cole can dance. Right, 25 years, let's have a celebration. He can start dancing around. Right, the crowd will start dancing around. The referees will start dancing around. Adam Pearce can start dancing around. Max Dupree can start dancing around. It'll just be one big fucking dance fest. I don't even know what I was talking about.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Solomonster Sounds Off.